Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Kelly Jean Kelly and Phil Deerking. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, about 74,000 years ago, the Mount Toba volcano erupted on what is now the Indonesian island of Sumatra. The eruption caused a worldwide environmental disaster. It may have destroyed ancient human populations in many parts of the world. But experts say some groups may have survived the disaster unharmed. Earlier this month, scientists announced that they had found tiny pieces of volcanic glass from the Mount Toba eruption. Their discovery, however, was 9,000 kilometers away on South Africa's southern coast. Some researchers believe the eruption may have caused world temperatures to drop, causing a so-called volcanic winter that lasted for many years. Scientists suggest this cold period damaged ecosystems and reduced food resources for people around the world. But the researchers in South Africa found evidence that the hunter-gatherers there continued to thrive. Pieces of volcanic glass were found in a rock shelter at a place called Pinnacle Point near the town of Mossel Bay. Ancient people lived, cooked food, and slept there. They made tools out of stone, bone, and wood. Glass pieces were also found in an area about 10 kilometers away. The researchers said people lived in the rock shelter from 90,000 to 50,000 years ago. They found no sign that people left the area at the time of the eruption. They said the seaside location may have provided a refuge. Marine food sources like shellfish may have been less affected than inland plants and animals to the environmental effects of the eruption. The Mount Toba eruption sent large amounts of volcanic particles into the atmosphere. The particles dimmed the sunlight and possibly killed many plants. Scientists say it was the most powerful eruption in the past 2 million years. But they are divided over the eruption's effects. Some think it may have caused a human population collapse that became a near-extinction event. Others believe its effects were less severe. Curtis Marion is a paleoanthropologist with Arizona State University's Institute of Human Origins and Nelson Mandela University's Center for Coastal Paleoscience in South Africa. He spoke to the Reuters news service about the findings. He said, "On a regular basis through time, humans faced dire threats from natural disasters. As hunter-gatherers endowed with advanced cognition and a proclivity to cooperate, we were able to make it through this disaster, and we were very resilient." He added, "But this may not be the case now with our reliance on our highly complicated technological system. In my opinion, a volcano like this could annihilate civilization as we know it." The researchers' findings were published in the journal Nature.
When Americans are angry and believe they are right about an issue, they might use this expression, "I'm going to take it all the way to the Supreme Court." These words capture two important ideas. First, the Supreme Court of the United States has the final say in legal disputes. The High Court is sometimes called the Court of Last Resort. The expression also suggests that taking a case all the way to the Supreme Court is hard. Each year, the court receives about 7,000 requests to consider cases. The judges, called justices, rule on only 100 or so. Their job is to strike down laws or actions that violate the U.S. Constitution. Linda Greenhouse reported on the U.S. Supreme Court for 30 years. She points out that although the justices hear only a few cases every year, the court plays an important role.
It sits there as a symbol that there is a rule of law in the country that people can turn to, and I think it's a very important part of American culture.
The idea for the Supreme Court dates back to 1787. At that time, the men who wrote the U.S. Constitution described a court system with a number of lower courts and one high court. The judicial branch, as it was called, would be one part of a three-part system of government. Reporter Linda Greenhouse says the idea of the U.S. Supreme Court was unusual because it was designed to be independent from Congress and the president.
And so from the beginning, the U.S. had a Supreme Court that could talk back, push back, and actually define the boundaries of the law. And that was something that the world had never seen.
At first, Americans were not sure how important the Supreme Court would be. Not very, some thought. The court did not even have its own building, but moved from place to place. For a while, it operated out of the U.S. Capitol building in a meeting room lawmakers were not using. And the position of Supreme Court justice was not highly valued. One of the first justices, John Jay, resigned from the Supreme Court to become the governor of New York. Later, the president asked Jay to return to the High Court. Jay said no. The idea of the federal judiciary had too many problems, he said. He did not think the Supreme Court could ever earn the public's trust. So the president at the time, John Adams, asked someone else, John Marshall, to be a Supreme Court justice. That decision turned out to be very important. During his 34 years in office, beginning in 1801, John Marshall helped shape and strengthen the Supreme Court. One of his most historic decisions came in 1803. That year, Marshall wrote the opinion on a case called Marbury versus Madison. The case related to a man named William Marbury. He had been offered a government job at the last minute by an outgoing president. The new president and his Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, did not want to give Marbury the position for political reasons. But Marbury believed an earlier act of Congress required the president to appoint him. So Marbury took the dispute all the way to the Supreme Court. The justices at the time agreed that Marbury should get the job. but they did not order Jefferson and Madison to give it to him. Instead, the justices believed, the earlier act of Congress violated the Constitution. So the whole idea behind Marbury's case could not be justified. That decision was historic, not because Marbury lost his case, but because of what it said about the Supreme Court. The Chief Justice claimed the court's right to tell the rest of the federal government what the Constitution permits them to do. Michael Trachtman, a lawyer and writer, puts it this way.
Marbury versus Madison established that it is the Supreme Court who makes the final rules. The Supreme Court gets to say to the President of the United States, you cannot do that. The Supreme Court gets to say to the Congress of the United States, you've passed this legislation, it took you 10 years to do it, the President signed it. No, it's invalidated because it violates the Constitution.
Of course, the Supreme Court does not have any power to enforce its decisions. It does not have money or an army. Instead, it depends on Americans' respect for the Supreme Court and the rule of law. As a sign of the respect it commands, in 1935, the Supreme Court finally moved to its permanent home. The building is made of white marble, with tall columns and a long staircase. The Chief Justice who pressed Congress to approve money for the building, William Howard Taft, did not live to see it completed. But his dream for it was realized. Taft said he wanted it to show the dignity and importance of the Supreme Court in American life. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Cédric Vèvre owns the only bakery in the small French village of Lusigny-sur-Barse. Last summer, Vèvre decided to keep his business open every day of the week to serve visitors to the area. That decision may cost him. The French Department of Aube has fined the 41-year-old baker 3,000 euros, or about $3,600. Aube officials say he violated a local employment law. The law says bakeries cannot be open 7 days a week. Instead, bakers must take 1 day of rest. European media reports say Vèvre is refusing to pay the fine, and many in his community are on his side. About 2,000 people have signed an official message of support for Vèvre. Lusigny-sur-Barse sits near several beautiful lakes, as well as a protected park area. In fact, Vèvre calls his bakery La Boulangerie du Lac, or Bakery of the Lake. Travelers from across France visit the area during summer months. The Guardian newspaper reported that, until 2016, local officials had permitted Vèvre's shop to stay open every day of the week during the summer. However, officials refused Vèvre's request to do the same last summer. He stayed open anyway. Eric Chéret is an official with the French retail union, CLIP-P. He explained that the law for bakers and others in the food industry is meant to protect people from working too much. Chéret told France's The Local news site, "It's an artisanal trade where people can work a lot, much more than the legal limits." But the town's mayor, Christian Branle, is supporting Vèvre. Branle told L'Estéclair newspaper, "In a tourist area, it seems essential that a business can open every day during the summer. There's nothing worse than closed shops when there are tourists." I'm Phil Deerking.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By 1863, America's northern states and southern states had been fighting a bitter civil war for 2 years. Both sides felt the pressure of the costly struggle. The South was beginning to suffer from a lack of supplies and men for its armies. The North was beginning to suffer from a lack of fighting spirit. Larry West and Tony Riggs describe an anti-war movement that was growing.
Many Americans in northern states did not support the war policies of Union President Abraham Lincoln. Some said openly that they did not care who won the war. They just wanted to be left alone. Coal miners in Pennsylvania protested against a law drafting men into the Union Army. They rioted and attacked officials who tried to take them. Soldiers were sent to Pennsylvania to put down the riots. Farmers in Ohio also protested. They refused to be drafted. They attacked soldiers who were sent to arrest them. The worst anti-war riots, however, took place in New York City.
On July 13th, 1863, a crowd formed outside a New York draft office. Inside, Army officials were choosing the names of men who would be taken into the Army. Each name was written on a separate piece of paper. The papers were mixed together in a big box. The officials then began to remove the papers, one at a time. They made a list of the names. These were the men of New York who must go off to fight. On that day, however, the list was never completed. The crowd outside the draft office became louder. There were shouts of protest against the draft and against the Civil War.
Suddenly, a stone crashed through the office window, then another, and another. The army officials escaped, but a policeman inside could not get away. The rioters beat him badly. Then they set fire to the draft office and several buildings nearby. The riot spread across the city. The riot began as a political protest against the draft. Poor men opposed the draft because it permitted rich men to escape military service. The law said a man who was drafted could stay out of the army by doing one of two things. He could pay the government $300, or he could pay another man to serve in his place. If a drafted man could not do either thing, then he must join the army or be shot as a deserter.
In the wartime economy of the North, prices were rising much faster than wages. Even a man with a good job had a difficult time feeding his family. It was impossible for him to pay the government $300 or pay someone else to serve for him in the army. Poor men protested against the law. They said it was unfair. "It's a rich man's war," they cried, "but a poor man's fight. The rich man's money against the poor man's blood."
There was something else that deeply troubled working men in the North. Anti-war activists told them that the war was not being fought to save the Union, but to free Negro slaves. The activists said the freed Negroes would move north and take jobs away from whites. Many men believed this. They said they would not fight.
Then, on July 13th, the angers and fears of working men in New York exploded. Their attack on the draft office that day was just the beginning. The violence lasted 3 days. The rioters beat many policemen to death. They beat, burned, and hanged every Negro they could find. They also killed many whites who tried to protect the Negroes. By the time soldiers stopped the rioting, 1,000 persons had been killed.
The leaders of the anti-war movement in the North were members of the opposition Democratic Party. They wore on their coats a copper penny showing the head of a Native American Indian. This gave them the name Copperheads. One important Copperhead was a former congressman from Ohio, Clement Vallandigham. Vallandigham made a speech criticizing the Union government. He was charged with violating a military law that banned such criticism. He was arrested.
The former congressman was taken before a military court. He objected. He said if he had broken a law, he should be tried by a civilian court. He demanded this as his constitutional right. The military judges rejected his argument. They found him guilty, and they sentenced him to remain in a Union military prison until the end of the war. People throughout the North were angry. Many did not support Clement Vallandigham's ideas, but they supported his right to speak freely. President Lincoln could approve or reject Vallandigham's sentence. His decision would show which issue was more important, the citizens' right to free speech or national security.
Lincoln was a good politician and a smart lawyer. He found an unexpected way to deal with the problem. He neither approved nor rejected the sentence. He changed it. Lincoln ordered Vallandigham to be turned over to the Confederate Army. Then he explained that Vallandigham had not been arrested for criticizing the government. His arrest was made, Lincoln said, because he was trying, with some success, to prevent men from entering the army. He was urging soldiers already in the army to leave it. Mr. Vallandigham was not arrested because he was damaging the political chances of the administration or the interests of the commanding general, but because he was damaging the army, upon which the life of the nation depends. The Confederates welcomed the anti-war leader. They helped him get to Canada. Vallandigham continued his anti-war campaign from there.
President Lincoln was troubled by the anti-war movement and violent opposition to the draft laws. He felt he had to make citizens understand why such laws were necessary. He prepared a speech which explained his thoughts. "There can be no army without men," Lincoln wrote. "Men can be had only with their permission or without it. We can no longer get enough men willingly. So there is a draft. If you dispute this and declare that men are still willing to serve in the army, then prove it by volunteering yourselves in large numbers. Then I will give up the draft."
Lincoln never gave this speech. He felt it was too direct. Instead, he gave a different kind of speech to the people of the Union. "You want peace," Lincoln said, "and you blame me that we do not have it. But how can we get it? There are but three ways possible. First, to put down the Southern Rebellion by force of arms. This I am trying to do. Are you for it? If you are, then we are so far agreed. If you are not for it, a second way is to give up the Union. I am against this. Are you for the Union? If you are, you should say so clearly. If you are not for force and not for dissolving the Union, there only remains some kind of compromise. I do not believe any such compromise is possible."
Politicians urged President Lincoln to investigate the anti-war protests in New York to learn who had led them. He refused. Lincoln believed that starting an investigation would be like lighting a barrel of gunpowder. He already was fighting a bitter struggle against rebels in the South. He did not want to fight the people of the North, too. Southern leaders were pleased with the Copperheads' anti-war movement. Confederate General Robert E. Lee saw it as a sign of weakness in the Northern war effort. He also saw it as an opening for a military victory.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.